Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our explorations of the cultures of consciousness. I just spoke to a woman yesterday who was doing a panel at a Los Angeles art museum on cults. And so she called up, and we talked about cults for a little while, and, you know, the sort of dubious use of that term. The term, you know, has a lot of charge to it. And it first came out as just a way to describe different kinds of religious groups. You know, you have large-scale religious groups like Protestantism or Congregationalism, and then those groups would sometimes split off into what they call sects, which were like split-offs of these bigger religious forms. Then there were these other formulations where there would be like really smaller groups that would often form around charismatic leaders and kind of separate themselves from the larger society. And back in the day, that was just used, called cults in sort of a descriptive term. But in the 1970s, especially, it became a much more charged term when there was this explosion of new religious movements as people coming out of the experimentalism and excess of the 1960s tried to make their way through, you know, reconstructing themselves, discovering a new self, dealing with the ravages and confusions and glimpses of liberation that many people went through in their younger years. And so people didn't like a lot of these because some of them were pretty creepy and manipulative. The term brainwashing was bandied about, you know, almost always in a fairly incoherent way, usually just describing a certain process of coercion, which most institutions and groups do in their own ways. The Army certainly brainwashes recruits during boot camp, et cetera, et cetera. But nonetheless, you know, there were these pretty unsavory groups. People were losing their friends, and their children would disappear into these things. And so the idea of cult became to be pretty negative. And then at the same time, you start having all these religious scholars coming in and going, hey, you know, one man's cult is another man's religion. And, you know, we're into religious freedom here in the United States. And so then you have this kind of backlash against the cult attackers. So again, it's a very complicated term. And the complications of this term are definitely brought up by the subject of our gathering together here today, the Source family. In some ways, the most remarkable, visionary, just juicy, complicated, inspiring, odd, disturbing in some ways, sort of a cult-like sect to emerge in this whole period in the late 60s and early 70s, done up in high California style, and was little discussed for a long time in people who read this stuff, people who wrote about it, histories of the 60s and 70s. They were known most through the cafe that they ran, which was in the Woody Allen movie, Annie Hall, and, you know, makes its appearances here and there. It was kind of a local fixture in Los Angeles. People didn't really understand the group very much. And now, as I was talking to this woman, she's like, and what about the Source family? The Source family is really coming back. And I'm like, wow. And the fact that the Source family is coming back, that it's on people's minds, that people are discovering the incredible richness of their imagery, their costumes, their clothes, their record albums, their riffs, their approaches to the sacred, their social experimentation, et cetera, is pretty much due to our guest today, Jody Willey, who's head of of Process Media and is just completed a remarkable documentary on the Source family, and earlier she put out a book on the Source family through Process, and I did an introduction there, and I also have a brief talking heads moment in the film, so I am, you know, definitely kind of particularly interested in this topic and having people be exposed to the Source family. And one of the most wonderful things about, you know, people say, oh, it's a great documentary, and there's tons of great documentaries out there. What makes this documentary unusual, or one of the things that makes it unusual, besides the unusualness of its topic, is the same thing that makes the book really cool, which is that the vast majority of the information comes from within the movement. Personal accounts, tons of film, tons of interviews with people who are inside the group and are, you know, still processing it today in a whole variety of different ways, some of them a little negative, a lot of them positive, a lot of them more reflective, but just tons of images, tons of film, of video, of photographs. It's a very visually and rich archive of material around this group, which was just the most, I mean, if you imagine the most over-the-top archetypal, had to make it up in a fiction vision of what a Southern California religious cult would look like and act like in the early 1970s, the source would totally outpace your imagination, which itself is remarkable. So I'm really happy to be talking to Jody today. Jody's also friends with Maja, our co-host here in Expanding Minds, so it should be a fine old time. Maja, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, Eric. How are you?
What is the most, since you've seen this film, you've been aware of the source for a long time, talked to Jody about it, et cetera, met some of the members and people who still revere Father Yod, the leader of the group. What did you use the single most inspiring thing or interesting or, you know, resonant thing about the source family?
Ooh, that's a good one. I mean, to me, I like you, have looked at lots of different cults and kind of the phenomena of them and how they happen. And to me, the thing about the source family that is the most inspiring is like the legitimate feeling and experience that everybody had in there. Like not just the cult leader, like just the sincerity of the events that transpired. Like some cults, you can kind of look at them and you're like, okay, like that, there's clearly like some mega manipulation happening and it's all kind of fantasy. But to me, the thing about the source family is there is a reality of the experiences that they had. And to me, that's like pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I also want to emphasize that, you know, when I use the word cult, when Maja uses the word cult, we're not using it in that pejorative sense that 70s mean, where if you say cult, that means brainwashing, it means manipulation. It can mean those things because they're very weird social experiments. But, you know, that's not necessarily the way to look at them. And it also tends to undermine how people in them experience their own autonomy and their own agency. I remember I met this, like, wonderful New York poet named Sparrow, you know, who's, you know, I think of the 60s, 70s generation, and super affable guy. And I was like, hey, how's it going? You know, tell me about you. You know, what did you do in the 70s? And he was like, oh, in the 70s, my wife and I were in cults. And he was just like, you know, that's what we were doing, and we went through that, and, you know, you learn some things, and some things piss you off, and then you move on. And you're like, and a lot of people I know who went through things like that, that tends to be their attitude. They still have positive feelings about it. They have mixed feelings, the way you do about most things you do in your life. But it's, you know, with some exceptions, it's rare to find people who are just like, oh, my God, I was brainwashed and tortured and psychically ruined for all time. You know, it's, that does happen. You got to admit it. But I just want to insist that we're not using it in that.
Yes,
in that
we love cults.
We love cults. All right, with that, let's bring on Jody Willey. Jody, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You know, it's so fun to finally see this film come out. I mean, it's just, I know you've been working on it for years and thinking about this group and how to represent their story to the world. I mean, it's a very interesting place to be sort of this outsider with a little bit of insider. Ultimately, you know, as you go through all this material and talk to the people and think about the decisions about what to show and what not to show, what to include, what not to include. So I don't even really know where to start, but I guess where you first heard about the source family or started to feel that there was something more for you here, there was something, a story that hadn't been told and needed to be told to a wider audience.
Yeah, you know, first I just want to say it's been a great honor to have the responsibility of working with this material. because the material itself could be presented in so many ways, you know. It would be very easy to take this material and do a typical, you know, cult story that are, you know, the kind of thing our media has been perpetuating for the last 30 years. But thankfully, you know, for me, I had the time to, well, the curiosity in the first place, but the time to get to know the source family members intimately and a number of them, and it just completely changed my own ideas of what I, you know, originally thought about this material. You know, I first came across it in 1999. A friend of mine was house-sitting for me, and I came over to visit, and he had this box set. It was this elaborate box set put out by this Japanese psych label called Captain Trip. And the box set had 13 CDs in it, and on the cover there was a picture of this white guru with like 40 little white-robed people sort of sitting in his belly, and then the title said God and Hair. And he said, Jody, I was just like, what is this? How have I not seen this before? Because, you know, that was like 99, and I've probably spent the last 20 years, you know, or more, you know, since I was even a young kid, just completely captivated by cults and fringe religious groups and, you know, fringe subculture. And I sort of, you know, considered that to be, you know, in some ways an amateur specialty of mine. And I'd never heard of the Source family. And I looked at the, you know, I looked at the photos on the inside, but unfortunately the insert, there was a booklet in the insert, and it was all in Japanese, so I couldn't read anything really about the family members, but I saw the record covers and the pictures of these gorgeous people. And then, you know, he told me that they'd been in Hollywood, and I was just, I couldn't believe I hadn't heard of them. Looked on the internet, there was nothing there. And then a couple years after that, I saw one article by Byron Coley, you know, who was part of that, like, East Coast record collector community that found, you know, discovered the Source family records in the late 80s. And but it, you know, there was not much there. And then my husband at the time, Adam Parfrey, who I think you guys interviewed recently, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, Adam was at Amoeba Records. He was looking through the classical music CDs. And on top of the classical music CDs, totally out of place, was this student film on the Source family. And he looked at it, and he was like, ooh, I bet Jody would be interested in this. And he brought it home. And I was just like, oh, my God, how did you find this? I've been looking for information about these people. And, you know, it's so interesting because, you know, we're just seeing the photos and seeing the box set, you know, my own sort of cultural brainwashing at that time made me think, like, ooh, who is this cool, creepy cult? And I kind of associated them with, like, a, you know, kind of a quasi, you know, Manson group. They sort of reminded me of that. But after seeing this student film, which had interviews with the family members, I was very struck by the intelligence of the people, the charm that they had, and there was just something in their eyes that made me realize that they knew something I didn't, and there was something really deep going on within the family. And so I reached out a few months after that. I found a family website and reached out to them and asked them if they'd ever done a book, because, you know, when Adam and I saw the movie, we were, of course, thinking, like, oh, my God, we have to do a book if they haven't done one. And Isis Aquarian, you know, who's one of Father Yod's 14 wives and family documentarian, wrote me back right away and said, oh, it's so funny, you just contacted me. I've been, you know, working on this book for 7 years with my brother, Electricity, and we just finished it. And so that was how we ended up meeting each other. And then we signed them on to do the book. And then what I realized, you know, after I read their book, was that we needed to do a lot of additional work, you know, to make it ready for a general audience. But there was just incredible stories there. And I remember editing that book, my jaw would literally drop multiple times a day, every day, as I was just astounded by the story and the personal stories of what was going on. And, you know, what I realized after, you know, working on the book extensively and getting to know a number of people was that, you know, unlike my own prejudices, my own, like, very limited idea of what the family was about, these people were far from, you know, brainwashed sheep. They were some of the most independently minded people I'd ever met. And it was humbling, you know. I mean, of course, they all, you know, they've all got their own issues like any people, but, you know, clearly they'd gotten something very deep and rich out of the situation.
Yeah, well, I'm also just really curious. I mean, again, because I'm studying religion, and like you, you know, I've been a scholar of this, scholar fan of this stuff for such a long time. You know, and from that perspective, one of the, again, just to repeat myself, one of the wonderful things about the book and the movie, again, is just how much of the material is from the inside, because there's always this problem when you have an experimental cultural group that has pretty strong boundaries between what's inside and what's outside the group. And it's partly because they have strong boundaries that they're able to really, like, it's like creating a vessel, like a alchemical social vessel where you can try new things and really profound things can happen, partly because there is a sense of an in-group. And
yeah.
So when you're on the outside, you're like looking at it, you go, huh, you know, and then usually there's this sort of typical kind of documentary way of framing, you know, the outside, you know, and like here's the way that the larger society would look at that, and sometimes they're sympathetic, sometimes they're not sympathetic, sometimes they're strongly critical. But this material that you put out is very unusual in the literature in terms of, you know, larger media stuff, where it's not entirely from the group's perspective, but it's largely from the group's perspective in a very kind of sympathetic way. So I'm just kind of curious, like, as you were dealing with this and you're in this position of this curator, this portal into memory, you know, portal into cultural memory, where now people, you know, thousands of people now have a sense, you know, who are living in, let's say, in Los Angeles, who know about the history of new religious movements, like the source is now a very important sign of something that was, you know, while there's some weird stuff there, pretty positive and certainly mm-hmm. very creative, like profoundly artistically creative and juicy from a creative point of view. So what was that process like for you as you went from kind of an outsider, you know, hobby fan scholar to somebody who got to know these people and started to become friends with them and started to, in some sense, pick up your, I mean, how did your own feelings about Father Yod change, for example, as you
went
through this?
Yeah, it's a very good question, because, you know, my feelings, you know, changed all over the place as I was doing the first project. But I mean, I would say first, you know, from the beginning, after just seeing their self-published book and the student film and getting to know them better, I realized that what I wanted to do with this book, and this is the beauty of, you know, Adam and me running process, is that nobody can say no to what the ideas that we have for our books, you know? And so we can do stuff that normal publishers might not get or might, you know, just want to say no to or try to shape into something more quote-unquote commercial. And for me, what I found to be really important with this material was, from my experience, I'd either seen books on cults that were completely demonizing or they were whitewashed. They were by the followers, and they were trying to present this portrait of their group that just wasn't convincing. It didn't feel totally honest. And then the demonizing portraits of the other groups also felt so limited to me. And so what I consciously wanted to do with this book was create a book that was unlike any books I'd ever seen. And also I should mention that there are memoirs of people who have been in these groups, and oftentimes the memoirs are, you know, talk about their victimization. You see a lot of kids doing, you know, books, children who are in the family, and they focus on the victimization or the exploitational elements. And what was beautiful, I thought, about meeting Isis Aquarian and Electricity was that they were still true believers, you know. They still were convinced that that was the most extraordinary time of their lives, that it had given them these tools to work with. And that's what I found from a number of the family members, the same exact thing. So I wanted to specifically present a book that was, you know, written by the family members, even though I did help write the book. But the way that I helped write the book was really just, you know, sitting with Isis, sitting on the phone with Isis for hours and hours and hours like a documentarian, and just asking her questions about the family life, and then doing that with some other family members, and then doing research on the time period and the kinds of spirituality that they were involved with so I could help Isis write in her voice, you know, to let that be the predominant voice. Because what I found is, you know, especially with so many writers who write about this material, people who haven't experienced radical spiritual transformation on their own, they really just have no clue as far as what was the reality you know, the power, the transformative power, and the true magic that was happening.
Well, and that's really, like I said, what drew me to it too, Jody, was just the sincere experience that these people had, and that it was a real thing for them at the time. And
oh my God, yes.
Yeah, and you, like you said, you can tell by talking to them that they are just like intensely amazing, beautiful souls, and so that you can sense the reality in every moment of their being. It's not like they're just spewing some kind of rhetoric or, you know, whatever people might think happens, like Eric said, people's idea of what a cult is. Just by sitting and talking to them, you have a real experience yourself, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, a lot of this has to do with the person we haven't been talking about too much, which is Father Yode, and who was this guy. And just for people who don't know so much about him, Jody, could you just kind of, you know, give us a little thumbnail sketch of the guy, and then again talk about how your own sense of who he was changed as you went through this project.
Yeah, absolutely. Father Yode was an extraordinary person before he ever started the Source family. Very eccentric and powerful. He had grown up in Cincinnati. He had a single mother. His father had split up when he was a child, so he grew up during the Depression with a single mother, and was a, you know, champion archer. He was a wrestling champion. He was this very strong athlete who had gone to World War II and came back a war hero. He had a Silver Star, and then he started a gym in Chicago, and he married and had a child. But he left them to go audition for the role of Tarzan in California, and he just left his family behind, which is kind of a habit that he developed that he continued to do, which was, you know, leaving women when he felt that their time was, you know, up and it no longer really suited his purposes. And he went out to California, auditioned for Tarzan, didn't get the part but almost got it, fell in love with another woman, married her, and then fell in with the Nature Boys. And that was another thing about the Source family we could talk about for ages, which is the whole Nature Boy movement, the West Coast Beats, who were proto-hippies and who were living this fascinating life, you know, running around naked, living in caves, eating raw food, all the stuff that few people know about that, you know, that period. So he fell in with the Nature Boys. He also became very close with Paul Bragg of Bragg's, you know, the Bragg, you know, health food company, and he had a very deep interest in natural foods and healing, and so he became a sandal maker in Topanga. But then he got caught into a situation where he ended up a man came at him with a knife, an unhappy neighbor, and he killed this man with his bare hands because he was a judo champion and trained the military in judo, and he killed him with his bare hands, and it was, he got off on self-defense, but this created you know, an interesting sort of air about him. And after that, he and his wife, Elaine Baker, started the Awareen, which was this legendary restaurant in Hollywood that all the movie stars went to. It was one of the first organic natural foods restaurants in the United States, maybe the first gourmet one. You know, his first patron was Greta Garbo, who he turned around and had an affair with, according to Father Yode. And then, you know, I mean, he was always a ladies' man. The women always loved him. He was very handsome. He had a beautiful body, and he was very charismatic by all accounts. That's what I hear. So he started the Aware, and it was enormously successful. They branched out and started the Old World, which was like more sort of a slightly more casual eatery, but same thing, natural foods. All the rock stars went to it, all the movie stars at the time. Steve McQueen was a good friend of his. You know, everybody went. But then he had another problem in the late 60s. He had an affair. He was involved with this woman who was a TV actress, and the newspapers say that it was rumored to be an affair. He didn't tell that to the family members, but that's kind of the impression I got. There was something going on with them. She had a very jealous husband who was a wealthy, you know, he's a billionaire hotelier, and he ended up coming at Jim Baker, threatening to kill them both, and Jim Baker killed him again. And he killed him in the office of the Awareen, and he killed him with 2 karate chops and a bullet to the head because this guy came at him with a gun. And this time he went to jail. So for a little while before he got off. So he had a very, like, checkered history in Hollywood.
You know, what it reminds, yeah. Even at this point, what it kind of reminds me of is in the in, you know, the and Majno is all about this, is the whole, you know, kind of Mahasiddha tradition in you know, Tibet and India, where you have these, you know, amazing people who become amazing, you know, spiritual singularities, you know, people who are, they're on the fringes of the institution, but they're like, you know, completely tantric masters and whatever. And a lot of their histories, and it's part of the lore, is that they have these really intense, sometimes violent, sometimes lustful, sometimes intoxicated lives. And it's, you know,
struggle with desire.
Yeah,
I fully agree. And you could say Moses fits into that group too. You know, he killed a couple people, according, you know, and some people say that about Jesus in the apocryphal text, right?
Yep.
And, you know, that they have these very interesting past, and they knew violence. And that's what I found with, you know, Father Yod too. And then they have the spiritual transformation. And so what happened with Yod was, you know, after he had this, you know, he was jailed. He was basically blackballed and by all of his friends for a while. And he ended up getting thrown out of his restaurant because he had this kind of Alice B. Toklas moment where he fell in love with a young hippie. He had been this, you know, beatnik turned businessman, and he started taking acid, and he started smoking pot, he started listening to the Moody Blues, you know, and other bands, and he just became a full-on hippie. He just dropped out. So he got kicked out of his restaurant, and then, according to some sources, he either got money from somebody he met in Calabasas, a businessman, or he robbed a bank. We don't know for sure, but I have audio where he talks about robbing a bank, right, you know, when he was with Dora, this hippie. So I have a feeling some of the money that opened the source was bank robbery money. And he started the source. And it was vegetarian. It was raw food. He was very interested in spirituality at that point. But he was, you know, he'd sat before Manly P. Hall. He'd been a Vedantic monk briefly. But it was really when he met Yogi Bhajan in 1969, where he had a radical spiritual transformation, where he felt his kundalini go up his spine. And he just became this devoted follower of Yogi Bhajan. He actually put out flyers in his restaurant and bulletin boards out with Yogi Bhajan's quotes. He was hardcore, and Yogi Bhajan was priming him to run the ashram in Los Angeles. He took him to meet his guru. So that's kind of where Father Yod starts out. He has this very checkered past, possible bank robber, and has radical spiritual transformation.
Yeah, a couple of things to say there. Just one, you're right to emphasize the importance of the natural food stuff and the whole relationship between natural foods and both the hippie movement and just, you know, the world that we live in now, and really recognizing people who are trailblazers, and the way in which, you know, that's one of the ways you kind of define yourself religiously in some ways is about food. A lot of religion is about food. What you eat, what you don't eat, when you eat it, what's the ritual of eating it, who you eat it with. You know, it's a very strong way to create community, to create intentionality in the everyday, so that your everyday actions, the things you have to do as a human being, are themselves sort of part of a larger practice or a larger set, you know, of commitments. And he was able to bring that and then actually, you know, make a business out of it, and so that it becomes also this important cultural node. And so that's already, you know, incredible. And then the connection with Yogi Bhajan is really significant as well, because, you know, when we look historically, we think, oh yeah, this is where when the gurus started to come west and all the hippies, you know, started to follow the gurus, and they had these beliefs about this and these beliefs about that. But in some ways, the beliefs aren't as important as the practices and experiences that people started. And so when Yogi Bhajan comes over, he has this weird organization. There's some good stuff there, there's some crappy stuff there, but he you know, he brought in these practices, particularly around kundalini, that were very, very immediate, very, very powerful, and they were things that, you know, Americans were not experienced with. I mean, maybe occasionally it happens to people spontaneously, more so with drugs, sort of, although it's very different with drugs. And so, you know, he has this incredible internal experiential transformation that, you know, plugs him directly into this whole, you know, this whole new stream, this whole emerging stream of spirituality at that time. But before we go on, there's so much more to say. We got to take a break here, and we'll be right back after these messages. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Jody Willey about the Source family and the Source documentary, and talk to you in a moment.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou, and we're here with Eric Davis, speaking with Jody Willie about The Source, a very exciting new documentary film that Jody has helped make, and also a book that you guys should check out if you have not, from Process Media. So before the break, I really like what you brought up about the Mahasiddhas, Eric, and how archetypal figures like Father Yoda are, and that it is this kind of like recapitulation of this story and the archetypal nature of the Source family as like a microcosm for kind of what happens when people get together under any kind of, whether it's political or spiritual or familial situation. It kind of seems like this pattern repeats. And I wanted to ask you, Jody, in terms of that, just because you can see like people have a reaction to the book, people have a reaction to the film, and it hits people on this very kind of primal level. So I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about like how you've seen it, their experience, affect people that kind of like watch the movie or read the book.
Yeah, I mean, first I'd like to say it was really important to me when shaping this material to shape it in a whole new way. My goal in doing the book and doing the film was I wanted people to finish reading the book, finish watching the film, and never be able to see the experience of never be able to see the word cult the same, you know, the idea of cult the same again. And the same thing with cult leader, because so many of us, you know, again, have been brainwashed by the mass media and the counter-cult backlash, and then the 80s, of course, which made everything, you know, all of the best elements of the 60s and 70s just, you know, made everything seem like a mess and a failure. You know, what I wanted to, and thankfully, because Father Yod was essentially, according to all accounts, you know, of people that I spoke with within the family, he was essentially, ultimately, a benevolent leader, even though he was maybe, you know, like Yogi Bhajan said, stuck in his sex chakra. And he was at times manipulative, for sure. He had his moments of fallibility. You know, what I wanted to present was, you know, most of us with our Judeo-Christian conditioning, you know, we think about spiritual leaders as having to be these infallible characters, you know, and then something happens like Jimmy Swaggart where you realize he's been hanging out with all these prostitutes, etc. The way that Father Yod set himself up, and the way that many of these leaders did in these cults at the time was definitely more of the Eastern tradition, or like a Western magist, you know, where they're not supposed to be saints. They're people who are able to, who have these extraordinary gifts and powers that are able to initiate their followers into transformative experiences. And I find that he was very genuine in his ability to do that with the family members. And what's also interesting about Father Yod is I realized, you know, after doing the book, actually, that he fits the, you know, the Jungian hero archetype.
Yeah.
There's this Jungian hero archetype that Father Yod, I realized, fits to this bizarre key, and that is the humble, miraculous birth. Father Yod was born to, you know, to a poor working woman on July 4th at midnight. He was like a little patriot, you know, in Cincinnati. And then early proof of superhuman strength. Well, Jim Baker was voted the world's strongest boy when he was 8 years old. He was on the cover of a magazine because of that.
And oh, crazy.
And then this rapid rise to prominence, you know, which exactly happened when he had his rapid rise to Father Yod in a period of like 6 months, becoming, you know, a follower of Yogi Bhajan to his own leader in like 6 months. And then the fallibility to sin of pride and power. That's part of this Jungian, this not just Jungian, universal hero archetype. And then there's either a fall through either a betrayal or a heroic sacrifice that ends in his death. And so Father Yod hit all of these right on the head. It's so fascinating, his journey. And then what I also realized was what he was doing was he was leading the family members on a classic hero's journey, the whole Joseph Campbell hero's journey. The family members fit that to a T. And more than that, what I found is not just these family members, but all young people who were going through this radical spiritual transformation in the 60s and 70s, we're going on this hero's journey. We don't think about that much. We think of Luke Skywalker when we think about that. But it involves going into these depths that you don't know you had before and then having to come bring them back to society and going on, you know. And so that was just one thing that was really important to me, was to present this new view of these groups as being, I mean, sure, they could be dangerous. They were very messy. They were high-risk situations. But they also transformed the lives of an entire, you know, an entire generation of seekers, many of whom turned out to be some of the greatest visionaries of our time, like Steve Jobs. You know, Steve Jobs was a radical hippie who was living on a commune, who had his own guru. Stuart Brand, you know, one of the co-founders of the Internet, was a huge part of this culture. And then you have the guy who started Whole Foods. You know, John Mackey was a hippie in Austin doing the same thing. And I think most people, when they think about cults from the 70s, they think of damaged people who were brainwashed and end up with destroyed lives. And what I found through my personal research, meeting these people directly and just putting, you know, connecting the dots together, is that was far from the case. You know, just like Eric was saying, you know, about his friend who was like, oh, I was in cults in the 70s. Well, when I moved up to Port Townsend with Adam, you know, every other neighbor we had in Port Townsend was in a radical social experiment. They were in cults. They were on communes. They were in homesteads. And they were some of the most self-aware, beautiful people I've ever met. And that was what made me feel like I was kind of on a personal mission to just reshape this material in a way that could be compelling to the larger, you know, our larger culture now.
That's totally noble, but I also really want to put in a plug here for just how incredibly cool these guys look. I mean, their style.
You were rock stars.
Well, you're right, and that's why I was so lucky. See, I knew when I saw the material, because they were so gorgeous, they were so sexy. We had professional musicians who were like, you know, playing in bands that opened for Jimi Hendrix and Led Zeppelin. You had all of these. You had you had rockers already in the group. You had rock groupies in the group. You had fashion models in the group. You had, you know, you had the mayor's niece in the group. You had these very like sort of high end, sophisticated kids who came in, and they handmade all of their clothes, which were gorgeous. They all look like, you know, they look like Templars or Grecian goddesses. Like, they're very stylish. And then they made this incredibly cool music, which is some of the most collectible psych music of all time. So I knew when I was getting into it, like, I had my higher goals, but I also knew that the story was sensational enough and the people were beautiful enough and interesting and cool enough that this had to be the group to tell that story. You know, that's how I felt anyway. I don't know. Because all people on communes were that way. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's a huge part of it. And, you know, and also the way that they, you know, it was an era of sex and drugs. Some people got into new religious movements because they were overwhelmed by the energy and chaos and pleasure and confusion that can be associated with drugs and sexual experimentation. So, you know, some people became Jesus freaks, where they just, you know, quit all that stuff, even though a lot of their lives were you know, really animated in this, in a way that would be recognizable to somebody who was, you know, also knew about the Source family. Or you have people go into EST and other things where they sort of kept that at bay. And what's one of the things that I find really interesting about the Source family, again, it's a more alchemical or tantric approach, where they continued to sort of use these forces, but they did them in very special ways, where they were almost kind of capturing sort of the energy of those things and then driving them towards very, you know, not towards the party, although I'm sure, you know, they partied at points too, which was also kind of charming, but just the way in the morning they would, you know, when they'd get up very early for their sort of ritual meditation and you know, it was grueling. You got to get up at 4 a.m. or whatever, and it, you know, no joke. And then during that process, there's a moment where they pass around the sacred smoke, and it's a limited amount, and it's directly used as kind of fuel. So it's like they're not denying all of these more chaotic cultural, you know, energies that are part of the counterculture and part of hedonism and part of, you know, that whole world of seeking has these sort of hedonistic elements to it. But at the same time, you know, they captured it in really interesting ways. The issue of sex is more complicated, and you know, in a way, that's of course the hardest thing to sort of talk about. And I would really like to hear you riff a little on how you dealt with that yourself in terms of your own feelings, but then also when it came to, you know, representing some of these stories in the documentary. Because as far as I understood it, there was, you know, a period where, while there was a lot of, you know, sexual energy going around, that Father Yod himself, you know, kept himself out of the fray, so to speak, for the most part. He had a single partner, and then at a certain point, he changes the tune, and he, you know, has all these spiritual wives, which from the outside can look just totally cheesy, and there's definitely a cheese element there. But there was something more kind of specific and unusual about the situation. So I know it's a complicated, you know, hopelessly complicated topic in a way, but I'd really like to hear how you've come to think about that stuff.
Yeah, it's a very complex situation because, you know, Father Yod came from the Yogi Bhajan world, where he knew that Yogi Bhajan was having all these mistresses, and yet, you know, he was purporting to not be that kind of a person. So he was really a hypocrite, you know, with his sexuality. And Father Yod, in some ways, you could say, you know, because he created the Aquarian Ten Commandments, one of the commandments was, a man and his woman are one, let nothing separate them. And he'd married Robin at that point, who was this beautiful 19-year-old. He was like 43, 44. And they, you know, he was monogamous with her for 3 years. And it wasn't until, you know, maybe the second year of the family, like this family's sex practices, you know, he basically took sex and he took the drugs and music and sort of taught everybody how to make those things sacred. That's what he was interested in doing. That was like their path to transformation and illumination. And so at first, the family members were only, it was supposed to be monogamous sex, and they were only having, you know, sex for purposes of procreation or magical ritual. And then they started doing the Dhyanism, which was Tantra, where they, you know, basically where they were having this very conscious interchange of sexual energies, and more sex was happening at that point. But what happened was, you know, Father Yod decided to, he wanted to take on other women, so what he did was he broke his own commandment. And so, you know, the hero succumbed to pride, and that was really what I found to be the beginning of the end of the Source family, through just, you know, the research and listening to other family members and talking about the story. And he started out by taking on a mistress, what he called a mistress, and then Makushla came in, who he was, like, madly in love with. So he had three women at first. And then it really wasn't until, you know, like 1974, even though it seems a little earlier in the movie, where he decided to basically, you know, create this council of women. And what he did, I mean, here's the truth. The truth is that Jim Baker was addicted to sex, clearly. Like, he was such a ladies' man. He was never able to be monogamous to anybody ever in his life until he was with Robin for 3 years. And ultimately, you know, according to people I've talked to in the family, he just needed variety with his women. He was just that kind of guy. He was not a monogamous dude. And so what he tried to create within the family, which, you know, you can sort of take it however you want, is a way where he could have sex with multiple partners and yet be honorable about it, as far as, like, being having it on the table. So he was not hiding it like the yogi did. And instead of, you know, doing what the yogi did, which was, you know, made these women keep a secret and also live in hypocrisy, he actually created this dynamic in the family where the women, those women became his quote-unquote women.
Super amazing and archetypal about that, too, is that is like a traditional patriarch thing. Like, kings of old, like, that's just what they would do, and it was very accepted, you know. And the harems, and the idea of harems, there's a word for that for a reason. I mean, I'm not trying to justify that at all, but that's also part of the story that goes along with a lot of these guys.
With these people in power who are charismatic and shamanic, I mean, look at, you know, well, there's Hugh Hefner, of course. He's totally accepted for having seven women or more, whatever he had with his girlfriend. But then also, if you look at the personal history of rock stars, you know, they rarely have one woman who they're monogamous with. They usually have, you know, they've got a broad selection. They've got women in every city. They've got a number of women that they're close with. And really, what Father Yod was doing was, was he was not denying that aspect of himself, but what he decided to do is he wanted to honor those women. He wanted to give them power within the family. And so what happened after that was he became Yehoah. He went from Father Yod to Yehoah, and he actually removed himself from a lot of daily activity as far as, you know, being this boot camp, spiritual boot camp instructor, and the women really ran the family. And this created a host of problems for a number of family members because people like Jen, you know, a lot of the men in the family told me that this was, you know, another downfall of the family because it was hard to talk to Father Yod after that. The women wanted to dominate his time. He stayed up in his bedroom. He wasn't interacting with everybody on a regular basis. And then there were power aspects, you know, with the women. So really, you think of a cult leader as being this powerful manipulator who's obsessed with power. Father Yod kind of flew in the face of that. He was like this sort of, in some way, this benign, like, autocrat who really did, ultimately it was his, you know, his say, but he wasn't interested in controlling people that way. He was not interested in the control, and he let the women do it. The problem was there were like three or four women who were interested in control, and that was when the family became a cult and a controlling aspect. So it was a very complicated and complex situation, not what people would assume.
Yeah, but it's also important, just the move towards female power in a religious setting or an intense religious setting is, we got to remember, totally radical.
And
you know,
definitely.
At that point, and even before then, if I recall correctly, in terms of the sexual mores that would work between the followers, not including him, that it was all about women's choice. You know, it was basically, you know, they'd say, "Okay, you boy," and you'd be like, "Score." And if you were not like up to snuff, you were just out of the game. You were the young male hunt was essentially kind of squashed, but not in a way that turned them into, like, you know, these the males in this group, you know, are very strong characters, and they're making music, and they're supporting the community in all these kind of ways, and it really isn't until that later phase that things get more funky. So, but even that is really radical, really kind of a genius move, even if it produces other kinds of problems.
Well, and it's even primal on a different level. Like, not only now is it archetypal people style, but it's archetypal animal style. Like, now we're going to, like, lion style or wolf style. We're now, it's like on a whole nother, like, level of primality, you know. So it not only is recapitulating a lot of those old patriarch archetypes, but even, like, animal style, you know.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, the bottom line is that Father Yod loved women. He really loved women. He loved to know what they think, you know, what they thought. He loved everything about them, and he really, truly respected them and taught his sons. You have to realize, you know, and what's so interesting is so many people from the outside think that women were exploited within the family, that they were abused, that there's, you know, et cetera. But the women that I've found, you know, through the Source family are some of the strongest minded women I know. And one of them, Astral, in the Source family, this remarkable woman who lives in Mill Valley, who started two successful restaurants after she started the Source, is like one of the people who runs this this foundation that is affiliated with the United Nations that helps women in third world countries. She told me that she'd been brought up by her intellectual atheist, very successful surgeon father in Mill Valley, that women were useless because her mother was disrespected by him, and then she was disrespected. And she said that Father Yod was the first man to ever give her a true sense of her self-worth as a woman. And I feel like, based on the women I've talked to, even though he did manipulate people, and there was one woman I talked to who is a shamanic healer now who felt manipulated by him to have sex with her when she was like 19 and has now worked through that, they're still very powerful women. It's fascinating. And there's a lot of unique contradictions. And he did put people together. I mean, he fell prey to the same thing that a lot of cult leaders did at the time, which was he did at times, you know, tell, "I want you to be with this person." That happened for sure at times within the Source family. But overall, you know, the women were in charge of making those decisions, and it was really, you know, they would go to the son whose vibration was the highest. He would always tell his sons, "You will always, you know, a woman will always leave you for someone of a higher vibration."
We got about 5 minutes left here, I just wanted to, talk a little about what's happening with the film now. Is it coming up? Are you just going to festivals? What's the,
oh, yeah,
when
man,
are people going to be able to see it?
so much is happening, and I first want to just, like, recognize Maria Demopoulos, my co-director, this brilliant woman who's a very talented commercial director who came on board after I started the project and joined forces with me to co-direct and co-produce the film, and I could have never done it without her her expertise and just steadfastness. So I want to thank Maria Demopoulos. I want to thank Isis Aquarian, who was also an integral part towards making the film. There were so many other people, including our other producers and executive producers, but Isis and Maria especially helped us. And we just premiered the film at South by Southwest. It was very successful. We had sold-out audiences at every screening. Crazy. The response to it. And I just showed it at the Athens International Festival on Friday. And we're actually going to, we have a number of festivals lined up. Let's see, San Francisco is next. That's this coming weekend, actually. So for those of you in San Francisco, go to the San Francisco Film Festival website or go to thesourcedoc.com and you can see all of the dates and the information about our screenings. We have three screenings in San Francisco. One is on the 22nd. And then we have one on the 27th and on the 29th. I should also mention we have this great event at Aquarius Records on Tuesday for the event, you know, as well, where we're going to have a meet and greet with Isis Aquarian, and we're going to have a bunch of and other Source family members there and have a little party at the old Aquarius Records in San Francisco. And then Jin Aquarian is playing at the Vortex on Thursday, this coming Thursday, this next Thursday, before our other screenings. So we've got that going on, and then we have Seattle Film Festival coming up. We're going to Maryland right after San Francisco the first week of May, and then we just got news today that we got accepted to Silver Docs, which we're really happy about. It's a very prestigious doc festival in Washington, D.C., and so we got a lot of stuff going on coming up. Oh, I should also mention the panel you were talking about. You were speaking to that woman who's doing the cults panel at MoCA on Saturday. That's happening this Saturday from 2 to 4, and I'm actually one of the panelists on that panel.
Great.
So I'll be there at MoCA on Saturday. I'm very excited about that. We're going to talk about the art and aesthetics of the Source family, and that's going to be that should be a great conversation. So people who are in LA can go to that this Saturday. Lots of stuff going on.
Yeah, I'm glad all this stuff is going on, and people should definitely keep their eyes out for it, and eventually it'll be on DVD, of course. And so anyway, Jody, congratulations on all this. It's a great conversation, and thanks for being with us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you so much, and Eric, thanks for being a part of the project, and Maja, you too. I just appreciate having you both around to talk about these ideas. You know, we have our own kind of incubator going, and I'm really grateful for that.
Thanks, Jody.
Great. Yeah. Okay, well, from Maja and me to all you out there, keep your minds open.